It is Monday, July the 9th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, divers rescue four of 12 boys trapped in a Thai cave.
They've taken the weakest boys out first, so the others should be stronger, should have less problems.
Nominating a new U.S. High Court justice, also President Trump in this week's NATO summit.
I think the expectations are somewhat fearful that Donald Trump will inadvertently do serious damage to the cohesion of the NATO alliance.
Plus, a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Officials are saying it could take up to 4 days to complete the rescue of eight boys and their soccer coach from inside a northern Thailand cave. Authorities temporarily stopped their efforts today to replenish air tanks along with the cave's treacherous exit route. Then they resumed the rescue operation. Expert divers from Britain, the U.S., Thailand, Australia, and elsewhere on Sunday managed to get four of the 12 boys to safety. They were quickly transported to a hospital in the provincial capital. The entire group had been trapped there for more than 2 weeks. For some perspective on what it takes to do a cave rescue, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Forrest Wilson. He is a diving officer from the National Cave Rescue Commission. He says he was not surprised the rescuers were having success extracting the boys and their coach.
They have been discussing bringing them out and also were discussing leaving them, which I didn't ever think was a good idea.
There was some talk that they might have to stay there for many weeks until the monsoon season passed.
More like many months.
That would not have been a good idea in your view?
No.
Why is that?
Well, they were running out of oxygen in that small room. They'd been ferrying oxygen back there, but if the monsoons came, they wouldn't be able to do that. Not to mention, if the water came up high enough, that room would flood.
And that's pretty likely at this point.
Well, it's hard to say, but it's definitely a possibility.
The effort to get them out has already claimed the life of a former Thai Navy diver, so it points up the perilous journey that the divers have to make in order to reach them.
Well, that's partly true. The diver wasn't checking his air supply, but it's still perilous.
This has been described as a labyrinth network of caves and tunnels that the divers have to go through. Each boy is being led out by two divers as they wind 4 kilometers, about 2.5 miles, through pitch darkness. They trudge through thick mud, clamber over slippery, jagged rocks, and dive through narrow passageways swirling with cold, strong currents. This is a very dangerous journey.
Yes, it is.
Have you ever attempted something like this before, Forrest?
Well, I did a rescue where the water had gone up, trapped a bunch of cavers. So, yes, not to this extent, though.
What is the planning that has to go into such a dive?
Well, I don't know that it's anything special. I mean, those British guys, I know them. They dive in that kind of conditions all the time in England.
What kind of preparation has to be undertaken? What kind of equipment do they take, and what kind of training must they have?
Well, they're all what they call qualified cave divers, and it takes a while, from months to years. And as far as equipment, their standard equipment is 2 tanks, 2 regulators, 3 lights. You know, if you need something, you need more than one.
They have to be underwater, I imagine, for quite a while. I'm told it can be hours just to get there.
I don't think they're totally underwater that whole time. There are several places that they have to actually dive, but a lot of it's they're swimming on the surface.
How much of it is diving? What length of time do you think they have to be underwater, and how can those oxygen tanks support them for how long?
Well, that's the point. If they had to swim that whole way, they couldn't carry enough oxygen. The longest sump that I've seen is 30 meters, around a little less than 100 feet. The others are shorter, so there's not a whole lot of time spent totally under the water.
Can they get down and back on 1 tank, or does it take 2 tanks or more?
Probably it takes 2.
And are they able to navigate around these narrow passageways with those tanks, I assume, attached to their backs?
No, they don't attach them to their backs. They wear them on their side. It's a British thing. Well, it's a British sump diving thing. And if necessary, they can take one off or both off and push them in front of them. Having seen some of the drawings of the passageway. It's not exceedingly small. It's a little bit small to wear them on their sides in the normal manner, but it's not a terribly small passageway.
What are the conditions that have to be prepared for when you're traveling such a long distance? Is 4 kilometers a very long distance for divers to go?
Well, we do it all the time in Florida, but conditions are worse there because of the current and the visibility is not very good.
What are the prospects, you think, of getting the rest of them out?
If they don't wait too long and the monsoons come, it's real good. From what I understand, they've taken the weakest boys out first, so the others should be stronger, should have less problems.
If they're unaccustomed to these diving conditions, these young boys, what are they feeling? What kind of training would they be given before they're donned with the necessary equipment to get out? Are they concerned about claustrophobia, something like that?
No, they can't be very claustrophobic. They've never gone in there. But as far as training, they tried to train them with the normal diving gear, you know, a regulator and a tank. Apparently, they didn't do well, so they're using a full face mask. A full face mask doesn't take as much training. However, they're prone to leaking, and if you bump them on the cave wall and flood them, I'm not sure the boys would know how to deal with that. So that is one danger.
And so they're perhaps maybe taking them just a short distance at a time?
Yes, and they've got a diver in front, the diver in the back. And the boys are tethered to the divers. And one of the divers holding the bottle, the oxygen, the air bottle that the is supplying that full face mask.
And how long do you think this process would take, given the length they have to go? Does it take hours?
Well, a good diver is going to take about 5 hours to get out of there. So these aren't good divers, so you figure it's going to be over 5 hours, possibly six.
Forrest Wilson is a diving officer with the National Cave Rescue Commission. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. As President Trump prepares for his four-nation visit to Europe this week, the U.S. ambassador to Moscow is optimistic about his meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Here's AP's Mike Gracia.
Briefing reporters ahead of the trip, U.S. Ambassador to Russia John Huntsman said that the upcoming one-on-one meeting in Helsinki between President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin will be an accomplishment in itself. At a rally in Great Falls, Montana, Trump told his audience he's ready for Putin.
Will I be prepared? Totally prepared. I've been preparing for this stuff my whole life.
Before Helsinki, Trump will stop in Brussels for the NATO summit and then the United Kingdom to meet with British Prime Minister Theresa May. Mike Gracia, Washington.
And in his run-up for this trip, President Trump did little to ease European concerns by delivering some fresh broadsides against NATO countries, which he says he's pressing to fulfill their commitments to spend 2% of their gross domestic product on defense by the year 2024. Mr. Trump has argued countries not paying their fair share are freeloading off the U.S. and has threatened to stop protecting those he feels pay too little. VOA's Laurie London asked Australian National University scholar Stefan Freuling what expectations European leaders have going into the summit.
I think the expectations are somewhat fearful that Donald Trump will inadvertently do serious damage to the cohesion of the NATO alliance. one of the paradoxical issues about the Trump administration's relationship with NATO was that we had a lot of turmoil at the political level, but at the same time, a lot of the more practical measures that the U.S. has supported to give NATO greater cohesion and prepare NATO for deterrence and reassurance in the Eastern Europe have continued even under the Trump administration. And I think the fear is now that that may not continue, that Trump may decide to, for example, reduce U.S. troop commitments in Europe, which would kind of seriously send signals that the U.S. is withdrawing from its commitment to Europe.
Well, what would happen if that happened?
I think that's the big question that nobody really knows and people are maybe fearful about. I think that there's still an underlying assumption in Europe that Trump is obviously at an individual level hostile to a number of the NATO countries, but that overall the U.S. as a polity is still committed to its European allies. And I think if that is undermined, then we are really in uncharted territory.
Do you think part of the concerns are just sort of not knowing what to anticipate?
I think that's a large part of it, because if you look at the summit, the U.S. itself has actually proposed a new readiness initiative for NATO, which would see NATO hold 30 battalions, 30 squadrons, 30 major vessels at 30 days readiness for operations. That was driven by the U.S. That's supposed to be adopted as a new central plank for NATO's ability to reinforce itself in crisis for common defense or operations outside the NATO area. So you've got that signal from the U.S. coming of taking a major initiative to reinforce and support NATO. And on the other hand, you've got Trump on a personal level maligning a number of the NATO leaders. It's very hard to know what to expect and what the U.S. will do at this summit. That's part of the problem.
And what about the Putin factor? Russian President Vladimir Putin, he's been pushing for better relations with Russia, but creating hostility towards some of the closest European allies of the United States. How concerned are EU leaders regarding the meeting that Trump is having with Putin the following week?
I think there's significant concern. I mean, and to some extent, Europeans are in a bind here because there's very strong support throughout the political spectrum for having better relations with Russia. I mean, Russia will not go away as a major political player in Europe. It will always be Europe's most important neighbor. But the question is, on what basis those better relations? And one of the things that we haven't heard from Trump is what he will ask in return from Putin for any, for example, reduction in sanctions or any other things that he might do and give Putin as a concession or as a goodwill gesture. Ultimately, all Europeans want to have good relations with Russia, but the question is, what is the basis of those relations? And in the end, it was Russian actions in Ukraine in particular that have undermined the good basis of relations that we had in previous years and decades.
Australian National University scholar Stefan Freuling speaking with VOA's Laurie London. Well, later today, President Trump is expected to announce his nominee to replace High Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is retiring. The U.S. Senate will vote on the Supreme Court nominee, and many Democrats are upset that Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said the confirmation hearing will take place before the November national elections. McConnell, when faced with a similar decision in 2016 in the final months of former President Barack Obama's term, decided not to allow a vote on Mr. Obama's nominee to the High Court. That vote eventually happened when Donald Trump took office in 2017, and his nominee, Neil Gorsuch, was approved by the Senate. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with Jim Kessler. He's Third Way's Senior Vice President for Policy, and John Fortier, head of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. First up, Fortier's thoughts on what's at stake with the nomination.
Well, the court has been narrowly divided for a while, and of course, both sides see the court as the institution that might tip policy on a number of very important issues. Anthony Kennedy was more broadly on the conservative side. There is a 5-4 conservative majority, but he was the most common swing vote, the most likely to vote with the Democratic appointees. On some very big issues in the past, his legacy includes voting on same-sex marriage, which tipped in the direction with the four Democratic nominees and Kennedy ruling in that direction. So both sides are worked up about this. The replacement of Anthony Kennedy by a more consistently conservative justice, Republicans see as more likely to move the court in their direction. And I think that's true, but again, I would emphasize that Kennedy was broadly on the conservative side. And this term, for example, the 5-4 decisions, he was on the conservative side on all of them. So it would be a more solid conservative majority, likely, if Republicans get their nominee through, which I expect will happen. But the real battle, I think, would be if a liberal justice or a conservative justice stepped down, and the balance might tip much more significantly.
Jim Kessler, how do you see the significance of Kennedy's retirement and his possible replacement with a more conservative justice?
It's very significant. So the court right now is kind of right. It's going to be very right, politically right. And then you have to look at this in the context of how the nominee process for the court has fallen apart in the last few years. Merrick Garland was the choice of Barack Obama to be the Supreme Court justice when there was a vacancy towards the end of his presidency. Mitch McConnell refused to put that nominee up for a vote. He would have definitely passed. And, you know, so now we have a situation where Democrats feel like they've been cheated out of a Supreme Court justice. Just on the issues, the kind of how it affects people, Roe v. Wade, which is the decision in 1973 that makes abortion a right in this country, it's hanging on by a thread. It's very possible that Roe v. Wade will be overthrown with the next Supreme Court justice. So pretty serious issues at play.
Indeed. Back to you, John Fortier. Certainly politics does play a role, even in the highest court of the land. As Jim Kessler said, a number of hard-won rights for women, minorities, could possibly be overturned if a conservative justice is confirmed. Talk about the dilemma for both Republicans and Democrats. Many are saying that two Republican senators, that is, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski, who tend to support abortion rights, could be very critical in the upcoming confirmation hearings, that perhaps a confirmation would turn on their votes, because the Democrats, even if everyone votes against the nominee, still cannot overturn despite the razor-thin majority that the Republicans hold. And then the Democrats may also be in trouble, that is, some Democratic senators in what we call red states in the upcoming elections, if they're seen as voting against President Trump's nominee, perhaps some votes from conservative voters in their states who could vote for them might not vote for them. So it's quite dicey.
Well, it's interesting. Over the years, I think, especially going back to the Earl Warren Supreme Court, Republicans were the ones most worried about an activist Supreme Court. And there was, I think, more motivation for their voters to get out and vote on some of those issues. You know, as the balance has shifted on the court, I think there's certainly energy on both sides. You do see that. And the parties are more divided on issues like abortion than they were. There are fewer and fewer pro-life Democrats and fewer pro-choice Republicans. So I think you've laid it out right that there are a couple of Republican pro-choice female senators who are wavering a bit. I guess I expect probably they will end up voting for the nominee, whoever that is, and a few Trump, deep red Trump state senators who did vote, for example, for the earlier nomination of Justice Gorsuch. Three Democrats did vote for that nomination. They are up for election. Murkowski and Collins are not up for election. And I expect that some of them will probably end up supporting the nomination. So I think the Republicans have a very strong chance of getting this nomination through the Senate. But in theory, if two Republicans defected, they wouldn't. But it looks like maybe some Democrats will defect in the direction.
John Fortier is director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He and Jim Kessler, senior vice president for policy at the Third Way, spoke with Carol Castiel. She's host of the VOA program Encounter. You can hear more of what they had to say going to our website at voanews.com and search under the Listen tab for Encounter. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers in Australia have found that an automobile's natural vibrations can make drivers sleepy, increasing the risk of what is called drowsy driving. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration found, in the United States alone, that drowsy driving was responsible for 72,000 crashes, 44,000 injuries, and 800 deaths in 2013. In a new study, researchers from RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, detail evidence that normal automobile vibrations at frequencies between 4 and 7 hertz can affect a driver's concentration and alertness levels a mere 15 minutes after getting behind the wheel. The researchers made their findings after testing 15 volunteers in a virtual simulation of driving on a boring two-lane highway. They say that they want to increase the scope of their study to include a larger group of people. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music.
I keep on falling. And I love
Alicia Keys is an American singer-songwriter, a classically trained pianist. She was composing songs at age 12, and she was signed to a record label at age 15, and her debut album, Songs in A Minor, was released in 2001. It was critically and commercially successful, producing her first Billboard Hot 100 number one single, Fallen, earning Keys 5 Grammy Awards in 2002. Also a critical and commercially successful album, The Diary of Alicia Keys has a super hit track, If I Ain't Got You, showcasing Keys' phenomenal piano style. Has received numerous accolades throughout her career, including 15 competitive Grammy Awards, 17 NAACP Image Awards, and 12 ASCAP Awards. She sold more than 35 million albums and 30 million singles worldwide. Considered a musical icon, Keys was named by Billboard magazine as the top R&B artist for the first decade of this century and placed her number 10 on their list of the top 50 R&B artists of the past 25 years. Alicia Keys was born in 1981 in New York City, the daughter of a paralegal and part-time actress and one of three children of a flight attendant. Keys' father is African-American, her mother is of Sicilian and either Scottish or Irish descent. Keys is married to producer Kasim Dean. They have two sons. Often referred to as the Queen of R&B, Alicia Keys is a remarkable pianist and amazing singer, as displayed so well in her hit songs such as Girl on Fire. She's just a girl and she's on fire. Hotter than a fantasy, lonely like a highway. She's living in a world and it's on fire, filled with catastrophe, but she knows she can fly away. Oh, she got both feet on the ground and she's burning it down. Oh, she got her head in the clouds and she's not backing down. This girl is on fire. no doubt that Alicia Keys is a girl on fire. I mean, in the most positive sense. What an amazing singer. Hey, listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington hoping you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Alicia Keys.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, the West faces a number of threats, and nowhere is this more evident than in Central Europe. Indeed, Central Europe is one of the battlegrounds where several nations are attempting to increase their influence. There is Russia, which uses energy monopolies and dirty money and military and hybrid threats to cow its neighbors into a kind of vassalage. Russia has invaded two of its neighbors and grabbed their territory, said Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs Wes Mitchell. Chinese economic engagement, and thereby its ability to exert greater influence in the region, has increased significantly in Central Europe in recent years. And though they seem far away from Central Europe, Iran and radical extremism present very real threats to Europe and the West. They create misery and death for people in the Middle East. They spark mass migration on a scale not seen in recent history that radiates instability into the very heart of Western societies and politics, straining European cohesion, budgets, and social systems. And no one understands better than do Central Europeans what happens when despotism triumphs over liberty. This means that we must recognize these threats and take them seriously. That begins with strengthening our defense. It means that the United States must work with our allies to find alternatives to Russian and Chinese energy options. And it means that we must win the battle for hearts and minds. The West is a community, a group of nations bound together by history and heritage and cultures, by shared sacrifice and a common commitment to the cause of freedom, said Assistant Secretary Mitchell. The West is a powerful creative force that has shown resilience through history's darkest chapters. Our job today is to strengthen it, to strengthen ourselves from within, as nations, as Europeans and Americans, and as a Western alliance, so that our children may know the great blessings of peace and prosperity in their lifetimes that we have known in ours. Let us go forward together in that united task.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.